Leo, have you got a hold of him? And then there's a hand on my arm, but who can say if it belongs to my brother or to one of the strangers? The ones who want to cut my veins lengthwise and bleed me dry. The ones with headlight eyes and cavern mouths who want a piece of me to stick into their pockets and take away until there's nothing left. I do what any ordinary person would do when faced with a horde of wild animals gnashing their teeth and wielding microphones. I run. It feels fantastic. Keep in mind, I've been in a cage that's 20 by 40 feet, 2 stories high. I may not be as fast as I'd like to be because I'm wearing dress shoes and also I'm a natural klutz, but I managed to get far enough away to not hear their voices anymore. I can't hear anything, really, but the wind whistling in my ears and my breathing. And then, suddenly, I'm knocked off my feet. "Fuck it," Oliver wheezes. "I'm getting too old for this." I can barely speak because he's lying flat on my back. "You're 28, I grunt. He rolls off me, and for a moment we're both sprawled on the pavement, underneath a sign at a gas station. Unleaded, $2.69. "I'm sorry," Oliver says after a moment. "I should have seen that coming." I push up on my elbows to look at him. "There are a lot of people who want to see what happens with your case," he says, "and I should have prepared you." "I don't want to go back there," I say. "Jake, the judge is going to put you back in jail if you don't." I run through the list of rules in my head, the ones Oliver gave me for court behavior. I wonder why he didn't give the reporters the same rules, because clearly shoving a microphone up my nostrils doesn't qualify as good etiquette. "I want a sensory break," I announce, one of the appropriate responses to Oliver when we are at the trial. He sits up and draws his knees into his chest. A car pulls up to the gas pump a few feet away, and the guy who gets out looks at us strangely before swiping his credit card. "Then we'll ask the judge for one as soon as we get inside." He tilts his head. "What do you say, Jake? You ready to fight with me?" I roll my toes into the bells of the dress shoes. I do it 3 times because that's lucky. "I love the smell of napalm in the morning," I answer. Oliver looks away from me. "I'm nervous," he admits. This doesn't seem like a great thing to hear from one's attorney before going into a trial, but I like the fact that he's not lying to me. "You tell the truth," I say. It's a compliment, but Oliver interprets it as a directive. He hesitates. "I'll tell them why you're not guilty." Then he gets up, dusting off his pants. "So what do you say?" This phrase has always seemed to be a trick question. Most of the time, it's uttered by a person when you haven't even said a damn thing. But of course, the minute you point out that you haven't said anything, you have. "Do I have to go through all those people again?" I ask. "Yeah," Oliver says, "but I've got an idea." He leads me to the edge of the parking lot, where Theo and my mom are anxiously waiting. I want to tell Oliver something, but it fades in the face of this more immediate problem. "Close your eyes," he instructs, so I do. Then I feel him grab my right arm, and my mother grabs my left. My eyes are still closed, but I start to hear the humming of the voices, and without even realizing it, I make the same sound in the back of my throat. "Now, sing." "I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot no deputy." I break off. I can still hear them. So Theo starts singing, and Oliver, and my mother. All of us, a barbershop quartet, but without the harmony, up the stairs of the courthouse. It works, probably because they are so surprised by the musical number, the red sea of reporters parts, and we walk right up the middle. I'm so amazed that it takes me a while to remember what was stuck like a fishbone in my throat before we walked up the steps of the courthouse. 1. I said to Oliver the verbal equation we'll call P. You tell the truth. 2. He replied with Q. I'll tell them why you're not guilty. 3. In the logic equation of this conversation, I have made the assumption that P and Q were equivalent. 4. Now I realize that's not necessarily true. Before Jess and I started to work together, I had to go to social skills class at my school. This was largely populated by kids who, unlike me, were not particularly interested in joining the social scene. Robbie was profoundly autistic and spent most of the sessions lining crayons from end to end across the room. Jordan and Nia were developmentally disabled and spent all their time in special ed instead of being mainstreamed. Serafima was probably the most similar to me, although she had Down syndrome. She wanted to be a part of the action so badly she'd crawl into the lap of a stranger and hold his face between her hands, which was cute when she was 6, but not so much when she was 16. Lois, the teacher, had all sorts of interactive games that we had to participate in. We'd role-play and have to greet each other as if we hadn't been sitting in the same room together for the past half hour. We'd have contests to see how long we could keep eye contact. Once, she used an egg timer to show us when we should stop talking about a topic so that someone else could have a turn in the conversation. But that stopped quickly when Robbie went ballistic the first time the buzzer went off. Every day we had to end with a circle time, where we each gave a compliment to the person next to us. Robbie always said the same thing, no matter whom he was placed beside. I like terrapins. He did, too. He knew more about them than anyone I've ever met since, and probably ever will. And if not for him, I'd still be confusing them with box turtles. Jordan and Nia always gave compliments based on appearance. I like that you brush your hair. I like that your skirt is red. One day, Serafima told me that she liked hearing me talk about mitochondrial DNA. I turned to her and said I didn't like the fact that she was a liar, since she had just that very day used the hand signal we agreed on as a class, a peace sign raised in the air, to tell Lois that she was tired of the topic, even though I hadn't gotten to the part about how all of us in this world are related. That was when Lois called my mother, and my mother found Jess. I worked on compliments with Jess too, but it was different. For one thing, I really wanted to give them to her. I did like the way her hair looked like the stringy silk you pull out of a corn husk before it goes into the boiling water, and how she drew smiley faces on the white rubber rims of her sneakers. And when I went on and on about forensic science, she didn't wave a peace sign in the air. Instead, she'd ask more questions. It was almost like that was her way of getting to know me, through how my mind worked. It was like a maze. You had to follow all the twists and turns in order to figure out where I started from. And I was amazed that Jess was willing to put in the time. I guess I didn't really think about the fact that my mother must have been paying her to do that. At least not until that idiot Mark McGuire said so at the pizza place. But still, it wasn't like she was sitting there counting down the minutes she had to suffer with me. You would have realized that if you'd seen her. My favorite session with Jess was the one where we practiced asking a girl to the dance. We were sitting at a Wendy's because it was raining. We had gotten caught in a sudden downpour. While it passed, Jess decided to get a snack, although there wasn't much fast food that was gluten and casein free. I had ordered 2 baked potatoes and a side salad without dressing, while Jess had a cheeseburger. You can't even have French fries? Nope, I said. It's all about the coating and the oil they're fried in. The only fast food fries that are gluten-free are at Hooters. Jess laughed. Yeah, I won't be taking you there. She peered at my bare potato, my undressed salad. You can't even have a little butter? Not unless it's soy, I shrug. You get used to it. So this, she said, turning the cheeseburger over in her hand, is the kiss of death for you? I felt my face go bright red. I didn't know what she was talking about, but hearing her say the word kiss was enough to make me feel like I'd just eaten a butterfly instead of a cucumber. It's not like an allergy. What would happen if you ate it? I don't know. I'd get upset more easily, I guess. The diet just works, for some reason. She looked at the bun and picked a seed off it. Maybe I should go cold turkey, too. Nothing upsets you, I told her. Little do you know, Jess said, and then she shook her head and went back to the topic of the day. Go ahead, ask. I said, looking into my potato. So, do you want to go to the dance with me? No, Jess said flatly. You've got to sell it, Jacob. I'm going to the dance, and I thought since you might be there too... Blah, 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 she interrupted. I forced myself to look Jess in the eye. I think you're the only person who gets me, I swallowed hard. When I'm with you, the world doesn't feel like a problem I can't figure out. Please come to the dance, I said, because you're my music. Jess's mouth dropped open. Oh, Jacob, yes, she shouted, and then all of a sudden she was out of her seat and pulling me up and hugging me, and I could smell the rain in her ponytail, and I didn't mind at all that she was in my space and too close. I liked it. I liked it so much that you know what happened, and I had to push her away before she noticed, or worse, felt it hard against her. An old couple that was sitting across from us was smiling. I have no idea what they thought we were up to, but chances are autistic kid with social skills tutor was not high on the list. The elderly woman winked at Jess. Looks like that's one cheeseburger you won't forget. There's a lot about Jess I won't forget, like the way her fingernails were painted with sparkly purple polish that day, and how she hated barbecue sauce, how when she laughed, it wasn't a tiny, delicate thing, but a sound that came from her belly. So much time is spent with people superficially. You remember all the fun you had, but nothing specific. I'll never forget anything about her.
Oliver. When Jacob and Emma and I reach the defense table, the courtroom is already full, and Helen Sharp is reviewing her notes. The fun room's great, she says, sliding a glance toward me. Gotta get me one of those. By fun room, she means the sensory break zone, which has been erected at the rear of the courtroom. There are heavy soundproof curtains that seal it off from the gallery. Inside, there are rubber balls with knobs on them, and a vibrating pillow, and a lava lamp, and something that reminds me of the long fabric tongues in a car wash. Emma swears all of these function as soothing devices, but if you ask me, they might just as easily have come from a fetish porn movie set. If you're going to ask the wizard for something, Helen, I suggest, start with a heart. The bailiff calls us to attention, and we stand for the arrival of Judge Cuttings. He takes one look at the four cameras in the back of the courtroom. I'd like to remind the media they are here only by my decree, a decision that can be changed at any minute if they become intrusive in any way. And the same goes for the gallery. Outbursts will not be tolerated during this trial. Counselors, please approach. I walk toward the bench with Helen. Given the previous experiences we've had during closed court sessions, the judge says, I thought it might be prudent to check in with you before we begin. Mr. Bond, how is your client this morning? Well, he's on trial for murder, I think. But other than that, he's doing swell. I have a brief flash of myself sitting on Jacob's chest so that I can button his shirt, of him sprinting down the divided highway. Never better, Your Honor, I say. Are there any other problems we need to be made aware of? The judge asks. I shake my head. heartened by the fact that the judge seems to truly care about Jacob's welfare. Good, because a lot of people are watching this trial, and I'll be damned if I'm going to be made to look like a fool, he snaps. So much for human charity. And you, Ms. Sharp, you're prepared?
100%, Your Honor,
Helen says. The judge nods. Then let's begin with the prosecution's opening argument. Emma offers me a brave smile as I sit down on Jacob's other side. She turns around to locate Theo, who is tucked in the back of the gallery, and then faces forward as Helen begins to speak.
4 months ago, Jess Ogilvie was a bright, beautiful girl full of hopes and dreams. A graduate student at the University of Vermont, she was working toward a master's in child psychology. She balanced her studies with part-time jobs, like her recent position as caretaker for a professor's home at 67 Serendipity Way, Townsend, and student teaching, and tutoring special needs kids. One of her pupils was a young man with Asperger's syndrome. The same young man, Jacob Hunt, who sits before you as a defendant today. Jess helped Jacob specifically with social skills, teaching him how to engage others in conversation, how to make friends, and how to interact in public, all tasks that were difficult for him. Jess and Jacob met twice a week, on Sundays and on Tuesdays. But on Tuesday, January 12th, Jess Ogilvie did not tutor Jacob Hunt. Instead, that young man, the same one she had treated with kindness and compassion, murdered her in a brutal and vicious attack inside her own residence. Behind the prosecutor's table, a woman starts weeping quietly. The mother. I don't have to turn around to see that. But Jacob does, and his face twists as he registers something familiar about her. Maybe the same line of jaw her daughter had, or the color of the hair. 2 days before her death, Jess took Jacob out for pizza on Main Street in Townsend. You'll hear evidence from Callista Spatakopoulos, the owner of the restaurant, that Jacob and Jess got into a heated argument that ended with Jess telling Jacob to just get lost. You'll hear from Mark McGuire, Jess's boyfriend, that when he saw her later that night and on Monday, she was fine, but that she disappeared by Tuesday afternoon. You'll hear from Detective Rich Mattson of the Townsend Police Department, who will tell you how officers searched for any sign of Jess for 5 days to see if she'd been abducted, and finally tracked a GPS signal on her cell phone to find her bruised and battered body lying lifeless in a culvert several hundred yards from her home. You'll hear the medical examiner testify that Jess Ogilvie had abrasions on her back, choke marks around her neck, a broken nose, and bruises on her face, a broken tooth, and that her underwear was on backward. I scan the faces of the jurors, each of whom is thinking, what kind of an animal would do that to a girl? And then glancing furtively at Jacob. And, ladies and gentlemen, you will get to see the quilt that Jess Ogilvie's body was found wrapped in, a quilt that belonged to Jacob Hunt. Beside me, Jacob started to shake. Emma puts her hand on his arm, but he knocks it off. With a finger, I push the post-it pad I've set in front of him a little closer. I uncap the pen I've given him, willing him to take out his frustration in writing instead of having an outburst. The evidence we present will clearly show that Jacob Hunt murdered Jess Ogilvie with premeditation. And at the end of this trial, when the judge instructs you to decide who's responsible, we are confident that you will find that Jacob Hunt killed Jess Ogilvie, a vibrant young woman who considered herself his teacher, mentor, and friend. And then she walks to the prosecutor's table and rips the top piece of paper off her legal pad. Suddenly, I realize what she's about to do. Helen Sharp crumples the paper in one fist and lets it drop to the floor. He threw her away like trash, she says. But by that time, Jacob's started to scream.
Emma. The minute the prosecutor reaches for the legal pad, I can finish the end of her sentence. I start to rise from my seat, but it's too late. Jacob's out of control, and the judge, who has no gavel, is pounding his fist.
Your Honor, can we have a brief recess?
Oliver yells, struggling to be heard over Jacob's shrieks.
No wire hangers ever!
Jacob screams.
We'll take 10 minutes,
the judge says. And suddenly one bailiff is moving toward the jury to escort them out of the courtroom, and another one is coming toward us to take us to the sensory break room.
Counsel, I want to see you at the bench.
The bailiff is taller than Jacob and is shaped like a bell, heavy in his hips. He wraps one beefy hand around Jacob's arm.
Let's go, buddy,
he says, and Jacob tries to jerk away from him and then starts thrashing. He clips the bailiff hard enough to cause him to grunt, and then suddenly Jacob goes boneless, all 185 pounds of him, and falls heavily to the floor. The bailiff reaches down for him, but I throw myself on top of Jacob instead. Don't touch him, I say, well aware that the jury is straining to see what's going on, even as they're being shooed away, certain that every one of those cameramen has his lens trained on me. Jacob's crying into my shoulder, making small snuffling sounds as he tries to catch his breath. Okay, baby, I murmur into his ear. You and I, we're going to do this together. I tug until he starts to sit up, and then I wrap my arms around him, struggling to bear the brunt of his weight as we get to our feet. The bailiff opens the gate of the bar for us and leads us down the gallery aisle to the sensory break room. As we pass, the entire courtroom falls dead silent until we're ensconced within the black curtains, and all I can hear outside is the tidal swell of a murmur of sound. What was that? Never seen anything like it. The judge won't stand for stunts, a ploy to get sympathy, I'll bet. Jacob buries himself beneath a weighted blanket.
Mom, he says from beneath it. She crumpled paper.
I know.
We have to fix the paper.
It's not our paper. It's the prosecutor's paper. You have to let it go.
She crumpled the paper,
Jacob repeats.
We have to fix it.
I think of the woman on the jury who looked at me with abject pity on her face the moment before she was hustled out of the courtroom.
That's a good thing,
Oliver would say. But he's not me. I've never wanted to be pitied for having a child like Jacob. I've pitied other mothers who could slip by on loving their children maybe only 80% of the time, or less, instead of giving it their all every minute of every day. But I have a son who is on trial for murder. A son who behaved the same way the afternoon of Jess Ogilvie's death as he did minutes ago when a piece of paper was torn apart. If Jacob is a murderer, I will still love him. But I will hate the woman he's turned me into. One whom others talk about when her back is turned. One whom people feel sorry for. Because although I'd never feel that way about a mother whose child had Asperger's, I would feel that way about a mother whose child took the life of another mother's child. Jacob's voice is a hammer at the back of my head.
We have to fix it,
he says. Yes, I whisper. We do.
Oliver. That must be a record, Mr. Bond, Judge Cuttings drawls. We made it a whole 3 minutes and 20 seconds without an outburst.
Judge, I say, thinking on the fly, I can't predict everything that's going to set this kid off. That's part of why you're allowing his mother to be here. But you know, with all due respect, Jacob doesn't just get 10 hours of justice. He gets as much justice as he needs. That's the whole purpose of the constitutional system.
Gee, Oliver, I don't mean to interrupt, Helen says, but aren't you forgetting the All-American marching band and the flag that's supposed to drop from the rafters right now? I ignore her.
Look, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry in advance if Jacob makes you look silly or makes me look silly or...
I glance at Helen.
Well, as I was saying, I certainly don't want my client having fits in front of the jury. It doesn't do my case any good either.
The judge peers over his glasses.
You've got 10 minutes to pull your client together, he warns. Then we're coming back in, and the prosecution will have a chance to refinish her closing.
Well, she can't crumple the paper again, I say.
I believe you lost that motion, Helen replies.
She's right, Counselor. If Miss Sharp is inclined to crumple a boatload of paper, and your client goes ballistic every time, it's to your own detriment.
That's okay, Judge, Helen says. I won't be doing that again. From now on, only folded paper. She bends down, picks up the little ball that sent Jacob sky high, and tosses it in the trash can beside the stenographer's table. I glance down at my watch. By my calculations, I have 4 minutes and 15 seconds to get Jacob's perfectly zen butt into the chair beside me at the defense table. I stalk up the aisle and slip between the black curtains of the sensory break room. Jacob is hidden under a blanket, and Emma sits doubled over a vibrating pillow.
What else aren't you telling me? I demand. What else sets him off? Paperclips? When the clock reads 11:45? For Christ's sake, Emma, I've only got one trial to convince the jury Jacob didn't snap in a fit of rage and kill Jess Ogilvy. How am I supposed to do that when he can't even make it 10 minutes without losing control? I'm yelling so loudly that even those stupid curtains probably can't drown me out, and I wonder if the television cameras are picking up everything with their microphones. But then Emma lifts her face, and I see how red her eyes are.
I'll try to keep him calmer.
Aw, shit, I say, all the bluster fizzing out of me.
You're crying?
She shakes her head.
No, I'm fine.
Right, and I'm Clarence Thomas. I reach into my pocket and pull out a Dunkin' Donuts napkin, press it into her hand. You don't have to lie to me. We're on the same side. She turns away and blows her nose, then folds, not crumples, the napkin, and tucks it into the pocket of her yellow dress. I pull the blanket off Jacob's head. Time to go, I say. For a minute, I think he's coming, but then he rolls away from me.
Mom, he mutters, fix it.
I turn to Emma, who clears her throat. He wants Helen Sharp to smooth out the paper first, she says. It's already in the trash can.
You promised,
Jacob says to Emma, his voice rising.
Jesus,
I mutter under my breath. Fine. I stalk down the aisle of the courtroom and fish through the trash at the stenographer's feet. She stares as if I've lost my mind, which isn't entirely impossible.
What are you doing?
Don't ask. The paper is underneath a candy wrapper and a copy of the Boston Globe. I tuck it into my jacket pocket and walk back to the sensory break room, where I remove it and smooth it out as best as I can in front of Jacob. That's the best I can do, I tell him. So, what's the best you can do? Jacob stares at the paper.
You had me at hello, he says.
Jacob. I hated Mark McGuire before I even laid eyes on him. Jess had changed. Instead of focusing only on me when we had our sessions, she'd answer her cell phone or fire back a text message, and every time she did, she smiled. I assumed that I was the reason for her distraction. After all, everyone else seemed to get sick of me quick enough when we were in the middle of a conversation, and it was bound to happen with Jess, although that was my greatest fear. Then one day, she said she wanted to tell me a secret. I think I'm in love, she said,
and I swear to you, my heart stopped beating for a second. Me too, I burst out. Case study one. Let me stop here for a minute and just talk about prairie voles. They're part of only a tiny fraction of the animal kingdom that practice monogamy. They mate for 24 hours and then, just like that, they're together for life. However, the montane vole, which is a close relative, sharing 99% of the prairie vole's genetic makeup, has no interest in anything except a wham-bam, thank you ma'am, one-night stand. How come? When prairie voles have sexual intercourse, the hormones oxytocin and vasopressin flood the brain. If the hormones are blocked, prairie voles behave more like those slutty montane voles. Even more interesting, if prairie voles get injections of those hormones but then are prevented from having sex, they still become slavishly devoted to their would-be mates. In other words, you can make a prairie vole fall in love. The opposite, though, isn't true. You can't give a shot of hormones to a montane vole and make it lovesick. It just doesn't have the right receptors in the brain. It does, however, get a flood of dopamine to the brain when it mates, the hormonal equivalent of, man, that feels good. It's just missing the other two hormones, the ones that help pinpoint that ecstasy to a particular individual. Sure enough, if you genetically modify mice, removing the genes that affect oxytocin and vasopressin, they can't recognize mice they've already met. I'm a prairie vole, trapped in the body of a montane vole. If I think I've fallen in love, it's because I've considered it analytically. Heart palpitations? Check. Lack of stress in her company? Check. And it seems to me to be the most likely explanation for what I feel. Although I couldn't truly tell you the difference between feelings for a romantic interest versus feelings for a close friend. Or in my case, my only friend. Which is why, when Jess told me she was in love, I reciprocated. Her eyes widened, and so did her smile. Oh my God, Jacob, she said. We'll have to double date. That was when I realized we weren't talking about the same thing. I know you like having time alone for our sessions, but it's good for you to meet people, and Mark really, truly wants to get to know you. He's a part-time ski instructor over at Stowe, and he thought maybe he could give you a free lesson. I don't think I'd be very good at skiing. One of the hallmarks of Asperger's is that we can barely walk and chew gum at the same time. I'm forever tripping over my feet or stumbling on a curb. I could easily see myself falling off a chairlift or snowballing down a mountain. I'll be there to help too, Jess promised. And so, the following Sunday, Jess drove me to Stowe and got me fitted for rental skis and boots and a helmet. We hobbled outside and waited near the ski school sign until a black blur whizzed down the hill and sprayed us in a tsunami of powdered snow. Hey, babe, Mark said, pulling off his helmet so that he could grab Jess and kiss her. In one glance, I could tell that Mark McGuire was everything I was not. One. Coordinated. 2. Attractive, if you're a girl, I mean. 3. Popular. 4. Muscular. 5. Confident. I could also tell that I was one thing Mark McGuire was not. 1. Smart. Mark, this is my friend Jacob. He leaned down into my face and yelled, "Hey, dude! Cool to meet you." I yelled back, "I'm not deaf." He grinned at Jess. He had perfect white teeth. "You're right. He is funny." Had Jess told him I was funny? Had she meant that I made her laugh because I told good jokes or because I was a joke? In that instant, I hated Mark McGuire viscerally because he'd made me doubt Jess. And up until then, I had known unequivocally that we were friends. So, what do you say we give the Bunny Hill a try? Mark asked. and he held out a pole so that he could drag me to the rope tow. "Like this," he said, showing me how to grab on to the moving rope. And I thought I had it right, but my left hand got screwed up with my right, and I wound up spinning backward and collapsing on the little kid behind me. The guy running the rope tow had it shut off while Mark hauled me to my feet again. "You okay, Jacob?" Jess asked, but Mark brushed her off. "He's doing great," Mark said. "Relax, Jake. I teach retarded kids all the time." "Jacob is autistic," Jess corrected. And I turned around so fast that I forgot about the skis and fell down in a heap again. "I'm not retarded," I shouted. But that statement is somewhat less resonant when one can't even untangle one's own legs. I will say this for Mark McGuire. He taught me how to snowplow efficiently enough to make it down the bunny hill twice, solo. Then, he asked Jess if she wanted to take a run up the big hill while I practiced. They left me in the company of 7-year-olds in pink snowsuits. Case Study 2. In laboratory studies, scientists have learned that, when it comes to love, a very tiny portion of the brain is actually involved. For example, friendship lights up receptors all over the cerebral cortex. But this isn't true with love, which activates parts of the brain more commonly associated with emotional responses like fear and anger. The brain of a person in love will show activity in the amygdala, which is associated with gut feelings, and in the nucleus accumbens, an area associated with rewarding stimuli that tends to be active in drug abusers. Or, to recap, the brain of a person in love doesn't look like the brain of someone overcome by deep emotion. It looks like the brain of a person who's been snorting coke. That day at Stowe, I did 2 runs with the help of a kid who was learning to snowboard, then inched myself toward the main ski lift. I leaned against a rack where people could store their skis while they were in the lodge getting hot chocolate and chicken nuggets, and I waited for Jess to come back to me. Mark McGuire is wearing a suit. He has dark circles under his eyes, and I almost feel bad for him, because he must be missing Jess too, until I remember how he hurt her. "Can you state your name for the record?" the prosecutor asks. "Mark McGuire." "Where do you live, Mr. McGuire?" 44 Green Street in Burlington. "How old are you?" "I'm 25, he says. "And what do you do for a living?" "I'm a grad student at UVM and a part-time ski instructor at Stowe." "How did you know Jess Ogilvy, Mr. McGuire?" "She'd been my girlfriend for 5 months." "Where were you on Sunday, January 10th, 2010? Helen Sharp asks. "At Mama's Pizza in Townsend. Jess had a tutoring session with Jacob Hunt, and I like to come along every now and then." That is not true. He just didn't like that she was spending time with me and wouldn't give me up for him. "So you know Jacob?" "Yes." "Do you see him in the courtroom today?" I stare down at the table so I can't feel the serrated edges of Mark's eyes. "He's sitting over there." "Let the record reflect that the witness has identified the defendant," the prosecutor says. "How many times before January 10th had you met Jacob?" "I don't know, maybe 5 or 6. The prosecutor walks toward the witness box. "Did you get along with him?" Mark is looking at me again, I can tell. "I didn't really pay attention to him," he says. We're in Jess's dorm room watching a TV movie about the JonBenet Ramsey murder case, which of course was one in which Dr. Henry Lee was involved. I tell Jess what's true and what Hollywood has changed. She keeps checking her voicemail messages, but there aren't any. I'm so excited about the movie that for a while I don't realize she's crying. "You're crying," I say, the obvious, and I don't get it because she didn't know JonBenet, and usually people who cry at someone's death knew them very well. "I'm just not very happy today, I guess," Jess says, and she stands up. When she does, she makes a sound like a dog that's been kicked. She has to stand on a chair to reach a high shelf where she keeps her extra toilet paper and Ziploc bags and Kleenex. When she grabs the box of tissues, her sweater rides up on the side, and I can see them, red and purple and yellow like a tattoo. But I've watched enough Crime Busters to know bruises when I see them. "What happened to you?" I ask, and she tells me she fell down. I've watched enough Crime Busters to know that's what girls always say when they don't want you to know that someone is beating them up. "We ordered pizza," Mark says, "the kind that Jacob can eat, without wheat in the crust. While we were waiting for it, Jacob asked Jess out, like on a date. It was hilarious, but when I laughed at him, she got pissed off at me. I didn't have to sit around and take that, so I left." Even worse than Mark's stare, it turns out, is my mother's. "Did you talk to Jess at any point after that?" Helen asks. "Yeah, on Monday. She called me and begged me to come over that night, and I did." "What was her state of mind?" "She thought I was mad at her." "Objection," Oliver says. "Speculation." The judge nods. "Sustained." Mark looks confused. "What was her emotional state?" Helen asks. "She was upset." "Did you continue to argue?" "No," Mark says. "We kissed and made up, if you get my drift." "So you spent the night?" "Yes." "What happened on Tuesday morning?" "We were having breakfast, and we started to fight again." "About what?" Helen Sharp asks. "I don't even remember, but I got really angry, and I sort of shoved her." "You mean the fight became physical?" Mark looks down at his hands. "I didn't mean to, but we were yelling, and I grabbed her and pushed her against the wall. I stopped right away, said I was sorry. She told me to leave, so I did. I only had my hands on her for a minute." My head snaps up. I grab the pen in front of me and write so hard on the legal pad that it rips through the paper. "He is lying," I write, and I push the pad toward Oliver. He glances at it and writes, ? "Bruises on her neck." Oliver rips off the piece of paper and tucks it into his pocket. Meanwhile, Mark covers his eyes and his voice cracks. "I called her all day long to apologize again, and she wouldn't answer her phone. I figured she was ignoring me, and I deserved it, but by Wednesday morning I was getting worried. I went over to her place figuring I could catch her before she went to class, but she wasn't there." "Did you notice anything unusual?" "The door was open. I went in, and her coat was hanging up, and her purse was on the table, but she didn't answer when I called. I looked all over for her, but she was gone. There were clothes all over the bedroom, and the bed was messed up." "What did you think?" "At first, I figured she might have left on a trip, but she would have told me that, and she had a test that day. I called her phone, but no one answered. I called her parents and her friends, and no one had seen her, and she hadn't told anyone she was leaving. That's when I went to the police." "What happened?" "Detective Mattson told me I couldn't file a missing persons report for 36 hours, but he came with me to Jess's place. I didn't get the sense he was taking me seriously, to be honest." Mark looks at the jury. "I skipped class and stayed at the house, in case she came back. But she didn't. I was sitting in the living room when I realized that someone had organized all the CDs, and I told the police that, too." "When the police began a formal investigation," Helen Sharp asks, "were you cooperative in giving them forensic samples?" "I gave them my boots," Mark says. The prosecutor turns around and looks at the jury. "Mr. McGuire, how did you find out what had happened to Jess?" He sets his jaw. "A couple of cops came to my apartment and arrested me. When Detective Mattson was interrogating me, he told me Jess was dead. Were you released from custody shortly thereafter?
Yes, when they arrested Jacob Hunt.
Mr. McGuire, did you have anything to do with Jess Ogilvie's death?
Absolutely not.
Do you know how she sustained a broken nose?
No,
Mark says tightly.
Do you know how her tooth got knocked out?
No.
Do you know how she got abrasions on her back?
No.
Did you ever strike her in the face?
No.
Mark's voice sounds like it's wrapped up in wool. He's been looking down at the floor, but when he lifts his face now, everyone can see how his eyes are wet, how he's swallowing hard.
When I left her, he says, she looked like an angel.
As Helen Sharp finishes, Oliver stands up and buttons his suit jacket. Why do lawyers always do that? On Crime Busters, the actors playing lawyers do it too. Maybe it's so that they look professional, or they need something to do with their hands.
Mr. McGuire, you just testified that you were actually arrested for the murder of Jess Ogilvie.
Yes, but they had the wrong guy.
Still, for a little while anyway, the police believed you were involved. Isn't that true?
I suppose.
You also testify that you grabbed Jess Ogilvie during your fight.
Yes.
Where?
On her arms.
He touches his biceps muscle.
Here.
You choked her too, didn't you?
He goes beet red.
No.
You were aware, Mr. McGuire, that the autopsy revealed bruises around Jess Ogilvie's neck, as well as on her upper arms.
Objection, the prosecutor says. Hearsay.
Sustained.
You're aware that you're testifying here today under oath.
Yes.
So let me ask you again if you choked Jess Ogilvie.
I didn't choke her, Mark argues. I just put my hands on her neck for a second.
While you were fighting?
Yes, Mark says.
Oliver raises his eyebrows.
Nothing further, he says,
and he sits back down beside me.
Me, I duck my head and smile.
This ends Disc 13. House Rules, Disc 14.
Theo. I was 9 when my mother made me go to a therapy group for siblings of autistic kids. There were only 4 of us. 2 girls with faces that looked like ground over a sinkhole, who had a baby sister who apparently never stopped screaming. A boy whose twin was severely autistic. And me. We all had to go around a circle and say one thing we loved about our sibling and one thing we really hated. The girls went first. They said they hated the way the baby kept them up all night, but they liked the fact that her first word had not been mama or dada, but instead, sissy. Then I went. I said that I hated when Jacob took my stuff without asking, and how it was okay for him to interrupt me to give some dinosaur fact nobody cared about, but that if I interrupted him, he'd get really angry and have a meltdown. I liked the way he said things. Sometimes that were hilarious, even though they weren't meant to be, like when a camp counselor told him swimming would be a piece of cake, and he freaked out because he thought he'd have to eat underwater and surely would drown. Then it was the other boy's turn. But before he could speak, the door burst open, and his twin brother ran inside and sat down on his lap. The kid reeked, and I mean reeked. All of a sudden, their mom poked her head into the room. I'm so sorry, she said. Harry doesn't like anyone but Stephen to change his diaper. Sucks to be Stephen, I thought. But instead of getting totally embarrassed, like I would have been, or pissed off, like I also would have been, Stephen just laughed and hugged his brother. Let's go, he said. And he held his twin's hand and led him out of the room. We did other stuff that day with the therapist, but I wasn't concentrating. I couldn't get out of my head the image of 9-year-old Harry wearing a giant diaper, of Stephen cleaning up the messes. There was one more thing I liked about my own sibling with autism. He was potty trained. At our lunch break, I found myself gravitating towards Stephen. He was sitting by himself, eating apple slices from a plastic bag. "Hey," I said, climbing into the seat next to him. "Hey." I opened the straw of my juice pack and poked it into the cardboard box. I stared out the window, trying to figure out what he was looking at. "So how do you do it?" I asked after a minute. He didn't pretend to misunderstand. He picked an apple slice out of the bag, chewed it, swallowed. "It could have been me," he said. Mama Spatacopoulos can't fit into the witness chair. She has to push and wedge, and finally the judge asks the bailiff to get a seat that might be more comfortable. If it were me up there, I'd want to hide under the stupid chair in embarrassment. But she seems to be perfectly happy. Maybe she thinks it's a testimonial to how good her food is. "Mrs. Spatacopoulos, where do you work?" asks the dragon bitch, aka Helen Sharp. "Call me Mama." The prosecutor looks at the judge, who shrugs. "Mama, then. Where do you work?" "I own Mama S.'s Pizzeria, on Main Street in Townsend." "How long have you run the restaurant?" 15 years this June. Best pizza in Vermont. You come by, I'll give you a free sample." "That's very generous of you. Mama, were you working the afternoon of January 10th, 2010? "I work every afternoon," she says proudly. "Did you know Jess Ogilvy?" "Yes, she was a regular. Good girl, with a good head on her shoulders. Helped me salt the walkway once after an ice storm because she didn't want me to throw my back out." "Did you speak to her on January 10th? "I waved to her when she came in, but it was a madhouse." "Was she alone?" "No, she came with her boyfriend and the kid she tutored." "Do you see that kid in the courtroom today?" Mama S blows my brother a kiss. "Had you ever seen Jacob before January 10th? "Once or twice. He came in with his mama to get pizza. Got celiac problems, like my father, God rest his soul." "Did you talk to Jacob Hunt that afternoon?" the prosecutor asks. "Yes. By the time I brought the pizzas they had ordered, he was sitting alone at the table." "Do you know why Jacob Hunt was sitting alone?" Helen Sharp asks. "Well, they were all fighting. The boyfriend was angry at Jacob, Jess was angry at the boyfriend for being angry at Jacob, and then the boyfriend left." She shakes her head. "Then Jess got angry at Jacob, and she left." "Did you hear what they were fighting about?" "I had 18 takeout orders to fill. I wasn't listening. The only thing I heard was what Jess said before she left." "Which was what?" Mama asks. The woman purses her lips. "She told him to get lost." The prosecutor sits back down, and then it's Oliver's turn. I don't watch cop shows. I don't really watch anything unless it's Crime Busters, since Jacob hogs the TV. But being in court is kind of like watching a basketball game. One side scores, and then the other takes the ball back and scores, and this goes on and on. And just like basketball, I bet it all comes down to the last 5 minutes. "So, you really don't know what the argument was about?" Oliver says. "No," she leans forward. "Oliver, you look very handsome in your fancy suit." He smiles, but it looks a little painful. "Thanks, Mama. So, You were, in fact, paying attention to your customers. I've got to make a living, don't I? She says, and then she shakes her head. You're losing weight, I think. You've been eating out too much. Constantine and I are both worried about you. Mama, I kind of need to get through this, he whispers. Oh, all right. She turns to the jury. I didn't hear the argument. You were behind the counter? Yes. Near the ovens? Yes. And there were other people working around you? Three that day. And there was noise? The phone and the pinball and the jukebox were all going. So you're not really sure what upset Jess in the first place? No. Oliver nods. When Jacob was sitting alone, did you talk to him? I tried. He wasn't big on conversation. Did he ever make eye contact with you? No. Did he do anything threatening? Mama S. shakes her head. No. He's a good boy. I just left him alone, she says. It seemed to be what he wanted. My whole life, Jacobs wanted to be part of the group. This is one of the reasons why I never brought friends home. My mother would have insisted we include Jacob, and frankly, that would have pretty much guaranteed the end of the friendship for me. The other reason is I was embarrassed. I didn't want anyone to know what my household was like. I didn't want to have to explain Jacob's antics because even though my mother insisted they were just quirks of his, to the rest of the free world, they looked freaking ridiculous. Every now and then, though, Jacob managed to infiltrate my separate life, which was even worse. It was the social equivalent of when I once built a house of cards using all 52 of them and Jacob thought it would be funny to poke it with his fork. In elementary school, I was a total social outcast because of Jacob. But when we got to middle school, there were people from other towns who didn't know about my brother with Asperger's. Through some miracle, I managed to become friends with two guys named Tyler and Wally, who lived in South Burlington and played Ultimate Frisbee. They invited me to play after school, and when I told them sure and didn't have to even call my mom to check if it was okay, that only made me seem cooler. I didn't explain that the reason I didn't have to call was because I spent as much time away from my house as possible, that my mother was used to me not coming home until it got dark out and half the time probably didn't even notice I was gone. It was, and I'm not just saying this, the best day of my life. We were flinging the frisbee around the softball field, and a few girls who had stayed after for field hockey practice came to watch in their short skirts, with the sun all caught up in their hair. I jumped extra high, showing off, and when I worked up a sweat, one of the girls let me have a drink from her water bottle. I got to put my mouth where hers had been a minute before, which was practically like kissing her, if you want to get technical. And then, Jacob showed up. I don't know what he was doing there. Apparently, it had to do with some kind of testing that was being administered at my school instead of his, and he was waiting with his aide for my mother to come pick him up. But the minute he saw me and called out my name, I knew I was screwed. At first, I pretended I didn't hear him, but he ran right onto the field. Friend of yours, Hunt? Tyler asked, and I just laughed it off. I whipped the frisbee in his direction, extra hard. To my surprise, Jacob, who couldn't catch a freaking cold if he tried, nabbed the frisbee and started to run with it. I froze, but Tyler took off after him. Hey, retard, he yelled at Jacob. I'm gonna kick your ass. He was faster than Jacob, big surprise, and he tackled my brother to the ground. He lifted his hand to deck Jacob, but by then I was on his back, yanking him off and straddling his body as the frisbee went spinning into the street. You don't fucking touch him, I yelled into Tyler's face. If anyone's going to beat up my brother, it's going to be me. I left him in the dirt, coughing, and then took Jacob's hand and walked him to the front of the school, where I couldn't hear the girls whispering about me and my dork of a brother, where there were enough teachers milling around to keep Tyler and Wally from jumping me in revenge. I wanted to play, Jacob said. Well, they didn't want you to play, I told him. He kicked at the dirt. I wish I could be the big brother. Technically, he was. But he wasn't talking about age. He just didn't know how to say what he meant. You could start by not stealing someone's goddamn frisbee, I said. And then my mother drove up and rolled down the window. She was smiling, a huge smile. I thought I was only picking up Jacob. But look at that, she said. You two found each other.
Oliver, I am sure that the jury isn't absorbing anything that Marcy Alston, the CSI, is saying. She's so drop-dead gorgeous that I can practically imagine the dead bodies she stumbles across sitting up and panting. The first time we came to the house, we dusted for fingerprints and found some on the computer and in the bathroom. Can you explain the process? Helen asks. The skin of your fingers, the palms of your hands, and the soles of your feet aren't smooth. They are friction-ridge skin, with lines that start, stop, and have certain contours or shapes. Along those lines of skin are a series of sweat pores, and if they become contaminated with sweat, blood, dirt, dust, and so on, they leave a reproduction of those lines on the object that's been touched. My job is to make that reproduction visible. Sometimes you need a magnifying glass to do it. Sometimes you need a light source. Once I make the print visible, it can be photographed, and once it can be photographed, I can preserve it and make a comparison against a known sample. Where do those known samples come from? The victim, the suspects, and from APHIS, a fingerprint database for all criminals in the United States who have been processed. How do you make the comparison? We look at specific areas and find patterns, deltas, whorls, arches, loops, and the core, the centermost part of the fingerprint. We make a visual comparison between the known fingerprint and the unknown one, looking for general shapes that match, and then we look at more specific details, ending ridges or bifurcations where one line might split into two. If approximately 10 to 12 similarities occur, a person trained in fingerprint identification will be able to determine whether the two fingerprints came from the same individual. The prosecutor enters into evidence a chart that shows two fingerprints side by side. Immediately, Jacob sits up a little straighter. The fingerprint on the right was found on the kitchen counter. The one on the left is a known sample taken from Jacob Hunt during his arrest. As she walks through the 10 little red flags that show similarities between the prints, I look at Jacob. He is grinning like mad. Based on your comparison, did you come to a conclusion? Helen asks. Yes, that this was Jacob Hunt's fingerprint in the kitchen. Was there anything else of note during your processing of the house? Marcy nods. We found a kitchen window screen that had been cut from the outside, and the sash jimmied and broken. A screwdriver was found in the bushes below the window. Were there any fingerprints on the sash or on the screwdriver? No, but the temperature that day was extremely cold, which often compromises fingerprint evidence. Did you find anything else? A boot print beneath the windowsill. We made a wax cast of the print and were able to match it to a boot on the premises. Do you know who that boot belonged to? Mark McGuire, the victim's boyfriend, Marcy said. We determined that these were boots he kept at the house, since he often stayed there overnight. Did you find anything else in the house? Yes. Using a chemical called luminol, we found significant traces of blood in the bathroom. Jacob writes a note on the pad and gives it to me. Bleach plus luminol equals false positive for blood. At some point, did you receive a 911 call from the victim's cell phone? Helen asks. Yes. Early on January 18th, we responded to a culvert approximately 300 yards from the home where Jess Ogilvie had been house-sitting and found the victim's body. What was the position of the body? She was propped up with her back against the cement wall, and her arms were folded in her lap. She was fully clothed. Was there anything else noteworthy about how the body was found? Yes, Marcy replies. The victim was wrapped in a distinctive handmade quilt. Is this the quilt that you found with the victim that day? The prosecutor asks, and she offers Marcy a bulky roll of fabric in all the colors of the rainbow, the pattern marred by dark brown areas of dried blood. That's the one, Marcy says, and as it is entered into evidence, I can hear Emma draw in her breath. Helen thanks her witness, and I stand up to cross-examine. How long have you been a CSI? 4 years, Marcy says. So, not that long then. She raises a brow. How long have you been a lawyer? Have you seen a lot of dead bodies at crime scenes? Fortunately, not as many as I would if I worked in Nashua or Boston, Marcy says. But enough to know what I'm doing,